The war in Ukraine, the biggest conflict in Europe since World War II, has now entered into its fourth year of devastation. And after all of this time, since the Russian army first launched its all-out invasion, Ukraine now stands in the most precarious position it's been in since the war's early opening days. Following an explosive meeting between Donald Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky in the White House at the end of February, Trump instructed the United States to temporarily sever all of its military aid and intelligence sharing with the Ukrainians as an apparent pressure tactic to try and force Ukraine into accepting some kind of a peace settlement with Russia. After Ukraine then indicated that it was open to a temporary 30-day ceasefire agreement with Russia a few days later, the U.S. military aid and intelligence sharing was restored again. But the Trump administration also showed the Ukrainians that for the next 4 years of this administration, the United States will no longer be as reliable of a partner as they used to be, and that their aid and intelligence sharing could always be withdrawn again in the future over some other issue. During those 6 days when American intelligence sharing to Ukraine was halted, the Russians and their North Korean allies managed to make enormous tactical breakthroughs against Ukraine's occupied area in Russia's Kursk province, threatening to encircle around 10,000 of Ukraine's most elite soldiers in the Kursk theater in the process, and prompting high-level calls within the Ukrainian military to abandon the Kursk operation before it became too late. If the worst indeed comes to pass for Ukraine and they are forced to abandon their hold in Kursk because of this, those 6 days of halted American intelligence sharing with Ukraine may have just cost them their biggest bargaining chip that they had acquired during the entire war, because Ukraine had been hoping to exchange their occupied territory in Kursk for Russian-occupied territory in Ukraine. If they end up losing all of it, Ukraine will be placed into an even worse negotiating position than they were in beforehand, with no occupied Russian territory left to exchange for any occupied Ukrainian territory. The past 3 years of total war resisting Russia's invasion have brought absolutely horrific costs upon Ukrainian society. Near the 3-year anniversary mark of the invasion in February of 2025, President Zelensky himself claimed that more than 46,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed in action since the invasion began, an almost certainly optimistic count. The Wall Street Journal published a claim in September of 2024 that as many as 80,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed during the war and another 400,000 others wounded, while The Economist published a similar report in November of 2024, which concluded somewhere between 60,000 and 100,000 killed and 400,000 wounded. If those reports from The Wall Street Journal and The Economist are even remotely accurate, it indicates that nearly 1 in every 20 fighting-age men in Ukraine have been either killed or wounded during the invasion over the past 3 years. An absolutely grisly statistic. Russia's human losses during the war are believed to be numerically worse, but Russia also has a much higher population and is better able to absorb the damage. Mediazona, an independent Russian outlet, has collaborated with BBC Russia in a massive project to try and confirm through open-source data the names of fallen Russian soldiers during the war. By the end of February of 2025, their project had confirmed the names of more than 90,000 Russian soldiers who had been killed during the war since 2022. But they believe that the total number of Russian soldiers killed, when including so far unconfirmed deaths, is more likely around 170,000. With another 550,000 more or so wounded. That adds up to an astonishing total of around 720,000 Russian military casualties suffered during the past 3 years of war against Ukraine. About the same number of casualties as the United Kingdom suffered throughout the entire 6 years of their experience in World War II. About 750,000. But proportionally speaking, Russia still remains in better shape than Ukraine does because of their much larger manpower pool. The casualty numbers for Russia suggest that roughly 1 in 30 fighting-age men in the country have been killed or wounded during the war, compared with a 1 in 20 fighting-age Ukrainian men. The fighting in the war has also consistently been getting more violent and intense with every passing year, despite little territorial changes along the front line making headlines. Across 2022, it's estimated that around 20,000 Russian soldiers were killed in action. Across 2023, another 50,000 more. And across 2024, Russia is estimated by the Mediazona and BBC Russia report to have suffered around 100,000 soldiers killed in action, and more than 300,000 others wounded just to capture an amount of land in Ukraine, about the equivalent size of the U.S. state of Rhode Island across the Eastern Front. But in addition to Russia's losses being proportionally fewer than Ukraine's losses, Russia has also made up for a lot of its own losses by gaining control over new populations, territory, and resources in Ukraine as well, while even further exacerbating Ukraine's military casualties. Ukraine has lost about 11% of its territory since the Russian invasion began in 2022, in addition to the previous 7% of their territory that was occupied by Russia and Russian-backed separatists before that since 2014. Across this 18% of Ukraine currently under Russian military occupation live around 5 million people who are nominally Ukrainian citizens, but whom Russia is currently trying to incorporate as their own citizens. Putin has demanded that all of these 5 million people within the occupied territories must renounce their Ukrainian citizenship and accept Russian citizenship instead, or face deportation. If most of them accept, then Russia has already gained around 5 million citizens for the losses of 170,000 soldiers and another 650,000 or so Russians who have emigrated abroad since the start of the invasion, coming out well ahead with a net positive of millions of people gained. Ukraine, meanwhile, has not only lost around 80,000 of their soldiers probably killed in action, and 1 in 20 of all of their fighting-age men killed or wounded, but they've also lost around 5 million more people to Russian occupation behind the front lines. And they've lost another 6 million other people who fled the country as refugees since the invasion began and have yet to return. Because of these astonishing losses, The Wall Street Journal has recently reported that the total population that's still remaining under Ukrainian control today could be as few as only 26 or 27 million people, a massive decline from their pre-invasion population of around 41 million, and only about half of Ukraine's population at the time of their independence in 1991, of just over 50 million. And in addition to their catastrophic losses in people and territory, Ukraine has suffered enormous blows to their infrastructure as well. On the occasion of the 3-year anniversary of the beginning of the invasion, the United Nations released an updated report that concluded that the cost of rebuilding Ukraine and reviving its economy after the war concluded now stands at approximately $524 billion, nearly 3 times greater than Ukraine's entire economic output for 2024. It will simply be impossible for Ukraine to ever rebuild itself and to ever recover from this catastrophic war without massive outside support and without firm outside security guarantees to deter the Russians from ever attacking the country again. But with further American support for Ukraine seeming shaky now, the question has to be raised. How badly has this war doomed Ukraine's future? And does Ukraine even have any chance at becoming a viable, prosperous state going forward? For starters, up until the Trump administration ordered the temporary halt in aid and intelligence sharing to Ukraine, the United States and Europe had been providing roughly equal amounts of military aid to Ukraine in lockstep with each other. According to the Kiel Institute for the World Economy, a German company that tracks international aid to Ukraine, the US had provided Ukraine with about $67 billion worth of military aid, while Europe, including the UK, had provided them with about $65 billion worth. If the U.S. under the Trump administration eventually ends their military support to Ukraine permanently, it'll effectively blow up what's historically been half of Ukraine's outside military support in the process. In many ways, though, that won't actually be as catastrophic for Ukraine as it might initially sound. European artillery production, for one thing, has dramatically ramped up in scale since the start of the invasion and is now high enough to nearly match all of Ukraine's wartime needs. According to data from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Europe is on track to produce about 2 million artillery shells for Ukraine this year through 2025, while the US is expected to only produce about 850,000 shells. European artillery production is, at this point, already more important to Ukraine than American artillery production. And yet, even still, European and American artillery production combined is still lower than Russian artillery production, because Russia is projected to produce about 4 million artillery shells through 2025, double what the Europeans are collectively producing. American artillery would help, of course, but it will not be as decisive as European artillery is now. Moreover, the most important weapon in this war has evolved away from artillery in the opening days to drones today. And Ukraine is almost entirely self-sufficient in drones now. By some estimates, explosive first-person view or FPV drones now account for around 70% of Russian casualties on the battlefield. And more than 90% of the drones that Ukraine is currently deploying on the front lines are being built domestically within Ukraine by hundreds of state and private manufacturers. In 2024, the Ukrainians built 1.2 million of their own drones for use in the war. And in 2025, they're currently on track to produce around another 4 million more drones all on their own. The Europeans can also help aid Ukraine's drone production even further by offering to help them with manufacturing engines for long-range and bigger payload capacity drones at a much higher rate. So, here again, the halt in U.S. military aid would not be especially catastrophic for Ukraine's drone war. But one major piece of U.S. military aid that would be effectively impossible for Ukraine and Europe to replace is America's advanced anti-air systems, especially their Patriot surface-to-air missile system. The Patriot system is uniquely suited to shooting down Russian long-range missiles. They're extremely advanced, complicated, and expensive to produce. Each one costs around $1 billion to build and can take up to 2 years to manufacture. And only the U.S. produces the interceptor missiles that the system fires. 7 Patriot systems have been gifted to Ukraine since the invasion began, at least 2 of which are believed to have been destroyed. The remaining 5 are completely indispensable for safeguarding Ukraine's largest cities like Kyiv and Kharkiv that are home to millions of people from Russia's largest and most advanced missiles. Ukraine uses a complex mishmash of various different anti-air systems to intercept missiles, rockets, and drones. But it's only the Patriot system that is so routinely capable of shooting down the most advanced of Russia's missiles. Europe has their own anti-air systems that they could supply to Ukraine, of course, but none of them are considered to be as capable or as advanced as the Patriot system is. If the U.S. permanently halted the flow of military aid to Ukraine, this would probably be the biggest consequence. Without resupplies of the Patriot's interceptor missiles, Ukraine's surviving Patriot systems will eventually run out of them, and that'll expose Ukraine's major cities and infrastructure to Russian missile attacks in a way that they haven't really been before in this war, which could end up leading to further Ukrainians deciding on leaving the country and exacerbating Ukraine's demographic and economic problems even further. In the event that the U.S. eventually does permanently abandon Ukraine's war effort or severely reduces support, European leaders have promised that they will be up to the challenge of continuing on supporting Ukraine for as long as it takes. Only hours after Trump ordered the temporary halt on U.S. military aid to Ukraine, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen proposed a massive plan to mobilize 800 billion euros to radically improve Europe's defensive capabilities and to continue providing huge military support to Ukraine. But as it stands now, the proposal is still exactly that, a proposal. And since previous European rearmament plans have fallen well short of their expectations, it's plausible that this plan will too, as the European nations remain pulled between domestic spending priorities and increased military spending. Despite the strong words and the grand plans that are coming out of Europe, Europe remains deeply conflicted on Ukraine beneath the surface. The EU, for example, after more than 3 years of total war in Ukraine, is still somehow buying more energy resources from the Russians than the value of the aid that they're giving to Ukraine. Throughout the third year of the war, between February of 2024 and February of 2025, the EU still purchased 21.9 billion euros worth of Russian oil and gas, filling up the Kremlin's war chest while they only provided Ukraine with 18.7 billion euros worth of financial aid in the same time frame, effectively providing Russia with 1/6 more cash as they provided to Ukraine. A study conducted by YouGov as recently as December of 2024 showed that while most Europeans feel that Ukraine isn't getting enough Western support to stop a Russian victory from happening, only a minority of Europeans in every country measured believed that it was their country's responsibility to be the ones to actually increase the support to Ukraine further. Many European nations with large and competent militaries, like Poland and Germany, have publics that appear to be very opposed to sending any troops to Ukraine as peacekeepers. A recent poll conducted in Poland, a frontline state highly concerned with their own security against Russia, found that an overwhelming 86.5% of the Polish public are opposed to sending any of their troops into Ukraine. While the German government has likewise said that Berlin is opposed to sending any of their peacekeepers to Ukraine either, without direct American involvement, which seems highly unlikely under the Trump administration. That eliminates two out of Europe's top five military spenders from any peacekeeping duties in Ukraine, leaving really only the UK and France who have publicly stated that they would be willing to contribute to a Ukraine peacekeeping force after the war is concluded. But even with their declared willingness to do so, though, they may all yet be empty promises because Russia has categorically rejected the idea of any NATO member state deploying peacekeepers to Ukraine at all. The Russian position has been clear that any NATO states deploying peacekeepers to Ukraine after a ceasefire or peace settlement would be interpreted by the Kremlin as an act of war, and they're probably not going to back down from that position. So would the UK and France still be willing to send their troops to Ukraine as peacekeepers if the Russians seriously threatened to immediately attack them the moment that they arrived? Would Russia ever even agree to a ceasefire in the first place if Europe insisted on French and British peacekeepers being there afterwards? Regardless, Ukraine's number one biggest problem and their greatest obstacle to surviving as a nation after this war are their own atrocious demographics. Even before the start of the current war, Ukraine's demographic profile was already arguably the most troubled in the entire world. After the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 and Ukraine's independence, the chaos of the transition led to a complete collapse in Ukraine's fertility rate, the number of children born per woman in the country. By 2001, the Ukrainian fertility rate had plunged to become what was, at the time, the lowest in the entire world, at only around 1.1 children being born per woman. Well below the natural population replacement level of 2.1 children per woman. While Ukraine's fertility rate has modestly recovered since then, it has never increased to even more than 1.5 children per woman since then. And the last time in history that Ukraine's fertility rate was ever at or above the replacement rate was all the way back in 1964, more than 60 years ago now. In literally every single year since the start of Ukraine's independence in 1991, more people have died or left the country than have been born in it, which has led to Ukraine steadily losing population every single year without pause ever since. Now, during the chaos of war, this demographic doom enveloping Ukraine has gotten even worse. The fertility rate has now fallen beneath one child per woman in the country for the first time, according to data from the UN Population Fund, in 2024. While Ukraine now simultaneously experiences the unfortunate distinction of having both the world's lowest birth rate and the world's highest mortality rate, with three times as many deaths taking place in Ukraine through 2024 as births. As a result of this, Ukraine's population pyramid today looks something like this. With a chasm of young people between their late teens and 30s who were born in the 1990s and the early 2000s. This is why the Ukrainian government has always resisted calls to lower their conscription age to include this demographic. At the onset of the war, Ukraine refused to expand the military conscription age to men younger than the age of 27, and they only reluctantly reduced the conscription age down to 25 years old in 2024. Throughout the entire war, Ukraine has never forcibly conscripted from the manpower pool that would normally provide the nation with its very best soldiers, young men between 18 and 24, because they are literally the smallest age cohort in Ukraine today. To call them all up for war en masse would risk annihilating Ukraine's considerably smaller, younger generation, which could doom Ukraine's ability to ever recover from the war permanently. Ukraine has thus been faced with an almost impossible choice to make ever since the invasion began. Concede territorial and sovereignty losses to Russia and spare their youth's future, or commit their youth to the war to gamble on a better outcome and risk destroying their future for good if the gamble goes badly. To make matters even worse for Ukraine's demographic future, the vast majority of the estimated 6 million Ukrainians who have left the country since the invasion began were women of childbearing age and children themselves, the majority of whom now do not have plans to ever return. With the loss of 5 million Ukrainians behind the front lines and the losses of tens of thousands of soldiers and civilians at a minimum, Ukraine's future will be incredibly challenging if they fail to attract most of the 6 million refugees outside of the country to return back after the war is over. Without most of them returning, Ukraine's economic redevelopment will be permanently stunted by chronic labor shortages and a smaller manpower base for the army to defend against another Russian attack in the future. This is Ukraine's single biggest problem for its future, and the issue from which all other problems stem. The country will only have a very narrow window of opportunity provided to it after the war is over to attract most of its diaspora back, or else it'll probably experience stagnation or even further decline for decades, as evidenced by the example of Bosnia. Bosnia was torn apart by a horrendous civil war in the early 1990s that saw around 1 million people fleeing the country as refugees, or just over 20% of the country's pre-war population. While most of these people eventually did end up returning back to Bosnia after the end of the war, the country has still struggled with its labor force and its population growth ever since. Younger and more educated Bosnians have remained more likely to emigrate away from the country ever since, which has led to a chronic brain drain and skill gap affecting the country's economy, leading to almost constant economic stagnation in Bosnia. After 2010, 15 years after the war had ended, the emigration rate out of Bosnia has actually steadily increased, and a survey in the country as recently as 2019 showed that more than a third of Bosnians still wanted to permanently leave the country for good. As a result, Bosnia initially began recovering some of its population after the end of the war, until it started sputtering and stagnating in the later 2000s. And it's been faced with continuous population decline every year since 2009 now. If Ukraine fails to attract back most of its refugees after the war is concluded, it might be doomed to follow a similar long-term trajectory of stagnation as Bosnia has after the end of its war. And in order to do that, Ukraine will need to be stable with security guarantees from outside powers that will help give most of the refugees confidence that another war won't explode again shortly after they return. But so far, nobody has appeared willing to truly give Ukraine those ironclad security guarantees. And that's why Ukraine is so eager to go about and try and acquire them. They know that without them, they stand little chance at attracting most of their diaspora refugee population from ever returning again. And with that, little hope of ever recovering their economy and building a better future. Much has also been made about Ukraine's supposed resource wealth contributing to the country's reconstruction after the war as well. But there's a lot of problems here beneath the surface that most people aren't really talking about right now. Ukraine claims to supposedly have nearly $15 trillion worth of valuable mineral resources within their internationally recognized borders, including what they claim to be the largest deposits of lithium, titanium, and uranium that can be found in Europe. Ukraine claims that their country is home to about 5% of the world's total mineral resources, including major deposits of 23 out of the 50 materials that the US government deems to be critical. The government claims that the country is home to about 6% of all the world's graphite reserves, and that they have enough titanium reserves to provide all of the US and EU's demand for a quarter century. These claims have attracted the notable attention of the Trump administration, which has sought to secure some kind of a minerals deal with Ukraine in exchange for further US military and intelligence support, and maybe even reconstruction support. But notably, absolutely no security guarantees. There's a lot of people who think that Ukraine's mineral wealth will feature prominently in the country's reconstruction after the end of the war. But there's so many problems with this plan that are generally being overlooked right now. For one thing, the exact extent of Ukraine's mineral resources is based on very limited data. The last known actual assessment of Ukraine's potential mineral resources that all of these claims are being based on today was conducted between the 1960s and the 1970s during the Soviet era, with old, outdated exploration techniques and technologies. Ukraine might not actually have as many valuable mineral resources as they claim to have. Even worse, a very significant amount of these claimed resources are currently behind the front lines within Russian-occupied territory. It's been estimated that roughly 53% of all of Ukraine's potential mineral resources surveyed during the Soviet era are currently within the Russian-occupied parts of the country, which is far from a coincidence. A major wartime objective of Russia's has, without a doubt, been to seize as much of Ukraine's valuable resources as possible to further cripple the country's future and to force them into bending the knee to Moscow. Out of all of Ukraine's most valuable provinces in terms of potential mineral wealth concentration, the Donetsk province is the single most valuable one, and the one that has not coincidentally experienced the most ferocious fighting of this entire war. And while the Dnipropetrovsk province is the second most valuable in terms of potential minerals, the Luhansk province is the third most potentially valuable, which Russia's forces have almost entirely occupied as well. Moreover, Russian forces have also managed to occupy more than 56% of Ukraine's hard coal reserves as well, which are heavily concentrated within the industrial Donbass region. Ukraine's hard coal reserves before the war were the sixth largest in the world, that heavily contributed to the country's energy profile. But with more than half of those reserves lost now, Russia has managed to increase their own hard coal reserves to jump from fifth place globally into fourth place globally ahead of Australia, while Ukraine has probably plummeted from sixth place globally down to 10th place, with fewer hard coal reserves still remaining within their controlled territory than Poland. Ukraine has also lost an estimated 20% of their potential natural gas fields and 11% of their potential oil fields to the Russians as well, further restricting the resources that they'll have access to recover after the war is over. The Trump administration has been attempting to bully themselves into some kind of American access to these potential Ukrainian minerals as a kind of after-the-fact repayment for past and future U.S. military and intelligence support. But it's also not clear how much this potential deal is factoring in that most of those potential mineral resources are behind the Russian side of the front line currently. Ukraine's potential minerals are also all almost entirely untapped right now, due to years of uncertainty over the conflict with Russia and a litany of internal problems within Ukraine, ranging from corruption to the aforementioned demographic issues. Starting up the mines to even begin extracting these potential mineral resources will be a massive project that'll take years to accomplish and huge piles of capital to get going. Worldwide, it takes an average time span of 18 years to actually develop a mine, and it usually costs anywhere between $500 million and $1 billion to do so. Then, after all that time and money just to get it up and running, a mine can then run for well over 50 years. Committing to building a mine therefore requires anyone to have a massive amount of confidence in the location's long-term stability, since much of the remaining potential mineral resource location sites in Ukraine, under Ukrainian control, are so near to the existing front line in Ukraine, and since the war between Russia and Ukraine has really been ongoing for 11 years now, ever since 2014, even if a ceasefire has managed to be reached, will any potential investors actually be that confident in going in to build out these mines? Will anyone be confident enough in the war actually being over for good to risk billions of dollars in investment? Ukraine's ability to actually fully exploit these potential minerals is further undermined by the country's probable labor shortages that it'll experience after the war because of their catastrophic demographic issues. And then, to still make the situation somehow even worse, you have to realize that mining is also just an extremely energy-intensive activity to perform. Worldwide, the mining industry alone takes up around 38% of global industrial energy usage every year, while it further takes up about 15% of total global electricity consumption. And Ukraine's electricity infrastructure has been catastrophically damaged by this war. Russian forces have carried out more than 1,000 documented attacks against Ukraine's power grid since the invasion began, with the attempt to destroy as much of it as possible. While several of Ukraine's most important power and substations have also been directly occupied by the Russians as well. The result is that Ukraine, as it currently stands now, has been left with only about one-third of its total pre-invasion power capacity still remaining. And the vast majority of that remaining power capacity is all being provided by just three remaining nuclear energy complexes in the center and the far west of the country, which the Russians have been reluctant to target with attacks out of fear of triggering catastrophic nuclear meltdown scenarios. As it stands now, Ukraine doesn't have the energy capacity available to it to consider large-scale mining operations. The entire country's energy infrastructure will have to be painstakingly rebuilt and upgraded at tremendous cost before mining operations can even be considered. And then after you throw in all of the other complications from the mineral surveys being decades old and potentially unreliable, to most of the potential minerals being in the Russian occupation zone anyway, to the probable Ukrainian labor shortages, to the fact that outside investors will be wary to actually put down the huge amounts of capital and time required to build out the mines, and you're left with the probable reality that any Ukrainian minerals agreement with the United States will be based on unrealistic expectations. Hundreds of billions of dollars will need to be provided to Ukraine just to rebuild the country back up to its state before the invasion. And without any firm outside security guarantees to Ukraine, there will always be the significant risk that after a ceasefire, Russia will just decide to invade Ukraine again when they sense that the time is right. A fear that will permanently hang over Ukraine's head like a specter that'll drive away any hope of significant foreign investment, any hope of large numbers of the refugees ever returning, and any hope of Ukraine ever being able to recover. But so far, it doesn't seem like anybody is going to be willing to give those vital firm security guarantees to Ukraine. Because deep down, everybody knows that Russia has never and will never abandon their long-term maximalist objectives towards Ukraine. Throughout this entire process of back-and-forth discussions on Ukraine's future between the Ukrainians, the Americans, and the Europeans, Russia's stated ultimate objectives towards Ukraine have never shifted a single time. So far, their demands for ending the war have basically remained the same since before the war even began in 2021. Russian officials still insist that because the provinces of Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Luhansk have been declared to be annexed into the Russian Federation, the Russian constitution is clear that Russia can never compromise on what they view to now be their territorial integrity. Since all of these provinces are now viewed as being core integral parts of Russia, Russia insists that they cannot legally agree on freezing the front lines as they currently stand, since doing that would leave significant amounts of these provinces beyond their control. Instead, Russia continues to demand that to even consider peace, Ukraine must fully withdraw from all of the territories of these provinces that they still control, even though Russian forces have never managed to take them through force. To do so, Ukraine would surrender their entire heavily fortified front line and approximately 21,700 square kilometers of their territory that they still control, about equivalent to surrendering territory the size of Slovenia. More than 1.3 million Ukrainians still live on this territory that would be surrendered to the Russians as well. 1.3 million human lives that would be turned over to a hostile force that is actively attempting to conquer and incorporate them. And 1.3 million more people that Ukraine would lose from its already struggling demography. To say nothing of the potential resources that would be lost across this land, especially in the Donetsk province as well. Russia still demands that Ukraine and Georgia as well be permanently barred from ever being allowed to join NATO. They still demand that Ukraine be banned from receiving foreign aid, and they demand that no NATO states be allowed to send any peacekeepers to Ukraine. They still demand that Ukraine commit to a massive reduction in the size of its armed forces by around 95% of what it currently is, complete with extremely strict limitations on the numbers of tanks, aircraft, and artillery pieces allowed in their army as well. Russia still demands that an amendment be made to the Ukrainian constitution that includes a so-called neutrality clause, binding whatever remains of Ukraine to permanent international neutrality, forbidding it from joining international military alliances like NATO. Russia still demands that Ukraine bans itself from ever being able to carry out joint military training exercises with any other countries without the explicit prior approval of Russia. And Russia continues to demand that Ukraine enshrine Russia, their invader, as their security guarantor state in the future. Russia is not and has never been interested in a compromise with Ukraine. Putin's Russia seeks nothing less than the complete and utter subjugation of Ukraine, no matter how long it might take. Russia has broken every single treaty and agreement with Ukraine that they have ever signed since the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Even if they do agree to a temporary ceasefire or peace roughly along the current front lines, Russia will eventually, sooner or later, try and come back for the rest of Ukraine later. Everybody knows that. And nobody wants to put their own people at a serious risk of war with Russia because of it. And so the security guarantees that Ukraine requires after the war to deter Russia and to become stable and secure are not very likely to happen. Ukraine will continue trying to acquire them, of course, because they also know that deep down without them, in the long run, they're going to be doomed. At the time I produced this video, Ukraine and Russia have been meeting separately with the United States and discussing the terms of a potential ceasefire after more than 3 years of continuous war. Russia, too, has been badly weakened by this war, especially in terms of the amount of equipment and materiel they've lost. And they likely won't be able to continue at their current pace of fighting for much longer than another year. Both sides are obviously interested in ending this war on as much of their own terms as they can manage. But the Ukrainians have recently lost the majority of what for months had been their single biggest bargaining chip, their pocket of occupied territory in Russia's Kursk province that they had hoped to offer in exchange for the return of some of their own occupied lands in eastern Ukraine. Initially, the Ukrainian armed forces managed to quietly gather together around 10,000 of some of the most veteran elite units across the border over last summer. And then they launched the largest ground invasion into Russia since the Second World War last August. The operation sought to acquire as much Russian territory as possible in order to give Ukraine more negotiating leverage, and it sought to divert as many Russian resources as possible away from the critical Eastern Front, where Russian forces have been making sustained, slow, but grinding gains. Initially, this new Ukrainian offensive into Kursk proved successful, as it caught the Russians in the area almost completely off guard, which led to the Ukrainians overrunning around 1,000 square kilometers of Russian territory in Kursk within only the first week of its beginning. The next part of this video will cover exactly how this whole operation unfolded and why it initially went so well for the Ukrainians before eventually turning into a disaster. And this next part covering Ukraine's Kursk offensive is also a part of my overall Modern Conflict series, a monthly video series that I produce that covers modern-day wars, conflicts, and military operations in depth. With nearly 50 other episodes that I've produced in this series, I've been uploading new episodes in Modern Conflicts every single month, and I've been doing that consistently for more than 4 years now, covering nearly every modern conflict in multiple battles. From the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war to Russia's previous wars in Georgia and Chechnya to America's war against ISIS. And you can go and watch all of these Modern Conflicts episodes right now on this video's sponsor, Nebula, where they can only be found because of the highly sensitive subject material that they discuss. And what's even more, when you sign up for Nebula, you'll also get access to all of the other amazing exclusive content that's available there from hundreds of other independent creators and podcasters, many of whom you probably already know as well, like Neo's Underexposure series that includes a deep dive documentary into the investigation of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 that was shot down by pro-Russian separatists over Ukraine in 2014. Along with other exclusive series from creators like Wendover Productions, Real Engineering, Mustard, and many others. And best of all, if you sign up by clicking the button that's here on your screen right now, or by scanning the QR code on your screen, or by following the link that's down below in the description, you'll receive an insane 40% discount off of an annual subscription, which means it'll only cost you $3 a month or $36 a year for all of this awesome exclusive content from myself and hundreds of other independent creators, with even more stuff getting added every single month. And if you already have a Nebula subscription and you want to gift one to a friend or a loved one, you can now do that as well with a gifted subscription with the exact same discount by following the link down in the description as well. I don't run a Patreon and I never will, so signing up for Nebula using my link is the absolute best way that you can help directly support what I'm doing here on Real Life Lore. And as always, thank you so much for watching.